Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of literally unearthing the past. This month, we get a story of underwater history as we visit with a researcher who examines battle sites in the Pacific Ocean, including the Battle of Saipan in World War II. Jennifer McKinnon is an associate professor in the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. And she joins us by phone. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Good to have you here today. And Mark Tveskov is here from SULA. Chelsea Rose is away this month. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
So tell us first, Mark, about your first encounter with Jennifer and her work.
Well, I remember seeing Jennifer's presentations at conferences, and I was really struck because the history of World War II that most of us receive comes through this kind of World at War documentary of good versus evil and Japanese versus American. And the presentation I saw told another story about how local people in these Pacific Islands were remembering and experiencing those same conflicts. So that really struck me as an archaeologist as a really interesting thing.
And so, Jennifer, you're really dealing with, unlike when we talk about, unearthing sites in the Rogue River Wars of the 1850s, you're talking about battle sites that involved people who are potentially still alive now.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not many left of them, but there are still people alive and also many, many family members who lost service members.
All right, I'll get into some of the public efforts you do with people in Saipan, but let's get an idea of the work you do. We're focusing on World War II here, but apparently you investigate Pacific battle sites from previous wars as well?
Yeah, so, I've worked on sites all the way from, the Spanish colonial Florida and or Spanish colonial period in Florida through to World War II. So I kind of bookend some of the longtime history and, as Mark has suggested, have studied, the American side, but also the indigenous side of that battle as well.
I saw pictures of you wearing scuba gear, so I imagine that you've gotten pretty good at going into the water yourself to look for the things you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit of training, but that's what I do, underwater archaeology. So I also teach students how to do that as well.
How did you gravitate toward the underwater end of things versus the digging in the dirt stuff?
I was trained as a terrestrial archaeologist in undergraduate, and whenever I found out that you could do it underwater, I became really interested in, sort of how the ships got to the New World. I was really focused on Spanish colonial research at the time, and so I just became enamored by it. My parents got me certified for my graduation present from my undergrad, and then I sought out graduate programs that taught underwater archaeology.
That may be one of the best presents I've ever heard of.
That's
here you
right.
go, honey. You're going to get certified in scuba.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're to blame.
So where did you get to go into the graduate program to learn this?
I went to Florida State University. At the time, they had a great growing program in underwater archaeology, not just in shipwrecks, but also in submerged indigenous sites as well, so Native American sites that are submerged on the continental shelf. So I had the pleasure of doing a field school focusing on both, indigenous or Native American and historic period.
There's going to be a difference between digging for or diving for material, war material, for example, from World War II, largely made of metal versus some of the colonial and pre-colonial stuff you were just talking about. I mean, what kind of shape is some of the stuff in that you're looking for, and how hard is it to recognize what it is you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had always really been interested in wooden shipwrecks, and then I went out to Saipan and saw all the World War II stuff out there, and the local community wanted to set up a heritage trail, and World War II hadn't really been my interest. It was too modern for me, too metal. but when I started diving on the wrecks and the aircraft particularly, I became enamored with their story and their history. So it really depends in terms of the sites. They can be well-preserved. If they're iron, they're, can be sitting down there. There's a lot of salvage that happened post-battle, post-war, so they look a little bit different because we've been salvaging some of the metal. But the aircraft sometimes can be sitting there on the bottom, pretty as you please, very recognizable.
I'm curious about the number of, say, aircraft that you've identified archaeologically around Saipan or one of these battle sites. Is it just a couple, or is it dozens, or in?
Yeah, we're about a half dozen, I would say. I've worked on close to a dozen sites, and we've identified about half of those. To the specific type, but even close to which one it might actually be.
Which one, as in which particular plane from a record of the battle?
That's correct. Whoa. Yes. Yep.
And how important is that to establish those kinds of connections, Jennifer?
Well, I think it's really important in telling sort of the history of the battle, because often people ask me, why do you study World War II? There's so many records, you know, that are in the archives. What more can we learn? And I think by looking at these sites individually and studying them on a case-by-case basis, we can start to pull out the history of the soldiers and sailors and pilots who flew the planes and operated the ships. And that's where it starts to become very personal.
We are talking on this month's Underground History about really underwater history with Jennifer McKinnon, an associate professor in the history department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. She's been investigating underwater sites for quite some time now, stretching from the Spanish colonial period up close to the present day. She's our guest by phone. Mark Tveskov from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology is with us again this month for Underground History, and you can join the conversation. Your questions and comments by phone and email are welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Jennifer, let's reset the focus, go a little wider here and help people understand the Battle of Saipan. It's a very big World War II battle. Lasted 3 weeks. Can you sketch out some of the particulars here?
Sure. Well, in early 44, the U.S. turned their focus to the Mariana Islands, and Saipan is part of the Mariana Islands, along with Guam and also Tinian, which was impacted, and Rota. And so when they turned their focus to that island, they knew that if they could get within range of Japanese mainland, then they could start to set up bombing missions directly from the Pacific, Western Pacific, to Japanese mainland. So getting those B-29s out there and occupying those airstrips was important to the U.S. So they started early bombardment. That's where we see some of, if we tie it to the archaeological records, some of the aircraft, the early aircraft like Hellcats and TBM Avengers that are in the water out there today, went and did early bombing missions and strafing missions to try and basically put the Japanese aircraft out of service and also the runways. And then on June 15th, they essentially launched the sort of D-Day of the Pacific invasion of Saipan, and many vessels went ashore, including amphibious LVTs, landing track vehicles, and tanks, of which we have seen in the water as well and recorded, so Sherman tanks. And it was a huge invasion. The U.S. had actually underestimated the amount of civilians on the island, so weren't really prepared once the island was taken on July 9th to deal with such a heavy civilian population. It was a bloody battle. A lot of lives were lost on both sides, about 3,500 U.S. and about 30,000 Japanese. The island is very sort of tropical Pacific with limestone caves, and so the Japanese did a really good job of digging in and staying within the cave system to protect themselves and move through the island. And so basically the U.S. troops had to go cave to cave and clear, and what made it difficult was the amount of Japanese, Okinawan, indigenous civilians that were on the island, because it was often hard to tell the difference of who was in the caves.
And where did the loyalties of the people of Saipan lie at the start of the battle, anyway?
Well, there, you know, that story is kind of complicated, because they the Japanese had come in and set up a lot of industry on the island with sugarcane and other fishing industries. And they had treated the indigenous Chamorro and Carolinian peoples, you know, in a kind and, you know, regular sort of manner, I guess, in the sense of talking about, you know, colonial presence. But they, towards the battle itself, towards the war and the battle itself, things sort of shifted a little bit. And when outside troops were brought onto the island, those troops that hadn't lived on the island, you know, there was a different sort of interaction. So the sort of cruelty and that kind of stuff, you know, started to take place because, after all, the Japanese were, you know, aiming to win a battle and keep the island secure. So a lot of the indigenous community was sort of conscripted into labor to help build the airstrips and move guns around and those kinds of things. And so, you know, there were some negative feelings about that, but there was also sort of a lot of propaganda as well, you know, that the U.S. troops would rape the women and, you know, eat the children or kill the babies and that kind of stuff. You know, you hear those sort of stories over and over again. You know, for the most part, the Japanese and sort of indigenous communities lived together in a colonial context for quite some time prior to the war.
And then after the battle, it became basically an American colony. And how did the indigenous population and the Americans interact with each other?
It did. So, you know, after the battle, like I said, the U.S. didn't actually have a sense of how many civilians were on the island. And so they really had a job of trying to build camps. So there were two camps that were created, Camp Sisupi and Camp Chalankanoa. And they separated the Japanese and Okinawan and Korean into one camp and then the indigenous Chamorro and Carolinians into the other camp. And so they were kept separate. And we've recently done some oral history interviews with some of the folks who are still alive who lived in the camp. So they would have been children. Mm-hmm. But they recall, you know, that it was hard at first in the camps, but as time went on, you know, buildings were built. They were, you know, they had running water and they could go to the bathroom and they were provided food. And that they had good relations with the soldiers who would give the kids, you know, sort of candy and that kind of stuff. And so many of the elders on the island actually speak of that sort of post-battle and post-war period fondly, in mm-hmm. that there were a lot of opportunities that were presented to them to build businesses and sort of build back up that island. But, you know, the island was absolutely devastated. Everything on the island was, you know, sort of turned to dirt and leaves. There weren't leaves on the trees, you know.
This was heavily bombarded. Sounds like the old bombed back to the Stone Age kind of talk.
It was really a rebuilding. And they also had to figure out, you know, those folks owned property and land and had, you know, property rights that dated way back, you know, even before the Spanish period. And so the U.S. government and the community had to sort out rights to property and where they went back to, because many houses were bombed and farms were destroyed. And so there was a process of having to go through that as well.
And amongst all that, and this was one of the things I was intrigued about with your research, was people were living amongst the ruins of the military stuff, the caves and the boxes of ammunition and wrecked tanks and things like that. And how did that play into the experience of the indigenous people in the long run?
The caves were really important, and it's been a fascinating area of research for me, because when you really kind of talk about the war, the strongest connection for the Chamorro and Carolinians are the caves, because the caves have a prehistoric history as well on the island. It's where they buried their ancestors. So there are, you know, ancient remains that are buried in the caves, but they also had rock art. And so that was their form of communication. They would paint and etch in the walls of the cave. So they have a very strong ancestral connection to the caves. And then, you know, over time and through to the World War II, that's where they retreated for safety. And so many of them know the caves that their families hid in and where they are in the property. And they go back and they, you know, ask you know, to go into the caves, ask the ancestors to go in the caves and have some offerings and things like that. So we did a project specifically on caves because we knew that that was sort of the almost the closest connection to World War II and the strongest connection that the indigenous community has. So we collected a lot of oral histories about surviving in the caves, but also about you know, just who owned the caves and how we can protect them for the future. One of the stories that we collected from an elder, her name is Escolastica Cabrera. She talks about how they were so thirsty when they were hiding in the caves that her dad told her and the daughters to catch their tears and drink them. You know, and so those sorts of stories really help us understand, you know, how the battle was fought, but also all the impacts of the community as well.
We are talking to Jennifer McKinnon on the Jefferson Exchange in our monthly Underground History segment with the folks at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Mark Tveska from SULA is here in the studio with me. Jennifer McKinnon is an associate professor in the History Department at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. Questions, comments about the Battle of Saipan as we talk about this and Jennifer's discoveries both on the land and underwater? 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email, it is jx@jeffnet.org. It seems like, as I was looking at your research, Jennifer, that several different cultures have passed through. We mentioned Spanish colonialization, Japanese, and I noticed that your research efforts made a real point of including the population of Saipan.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to, you know, have a sort of a multivocal approach, so many voices in telling the sort of the story of the island. When we focused early on World War II and created a heritage trail, a few of the locals said, you know, well, what about our maritime heritage? And so, you know, our next project after developing the World War II Maritime Heritage Trail was to turn around and do a indigenous maritime heritage study. And so we worked with the community to, for them to identify what was important to them in terms of their maritime heritage. So, you know, we went out and we recorded some of that rock art that had images of the cycle of seasons and crabs and turtles etched into the rock art. We went to well-known fishing areas and recorded those. We went to areas where they would cut down trees. Chalangalaidi, which means canoe, where they would cut down the trees to build the canoes because they were excellent seafarers. When the Spanish turned up, you know, they commented on how great a seafarers they were.
So they ranged far and wide from Saipan?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we've done a lot of work with the community as well to record also, you know, their history and their stories.
Now, when you developed the World War II Maritime Heritage Trail from the Battle of Saipan, that was actually about 9 years ago, it seems like. But the trail, as we pointed out, is not just on land, but also underwater. And while I saw the images of you in the scuba gear, I noticed there were also some images of people who can get out there by snorkel.
Yeah, absolutely. So the trail is composed of 9 sites, and some of the sites are even you can snorkel. So, in fact, the Sherman tanks that are right off the landing beach, you can swim out to in about, you know, 3 to 5 minutes on snorkel, and you can stand there around the tanks. There's 3 Sherman tanks.
We're both here in the studio shaking our heads because we want to be there right now.
Yeah. Actually, the locals usually use the 3 tanks as a swim route. So people who like to, you know, swim for their health and also, you know, to compete, they use that. But, yeah, so you can swim out to those. There's another site, an LVT A4, which is was known as the Marianas model. It was named after the Marianas because the soldiers who modified it, those modifications were sent back to the production line, and they produced the next line with those modifications.
And these are to get soldiers ashore for a land assault.
Yeah, absolutely. So they would put extra boilerplate on the front of the LVT so that because they were having to go over coral, it wouldn't puncture the bow and sink, and they put a boilerplate, metal boilerplate up around the gun emplacement because there was no shield for the gunner. which doesn't make any sense, you know. And so they were basically prolonging the life of the vehicle in themselves, you know, and troops still do that today. They modify, it's called in-field battle modifications or expedient field modifications. And so by studying those archaeologically, we were able to identify those. And that was, you know, one of the prototypes, I guess, to the Marianas model. So that one's in about 10 feet of water. It's a great little snorkel site. There's a lionfish on it and some pretty coral, surrounded by, you know, nice, pretty white sand. So the deepest site is probably about 35 feet of water. So it's actually a really nice place for beginning divers, but also just divers who, you know, if they want to go out and just be adventurous and hit, you know, 5 to 6 to 9 sites a day, they actually can.
Wow.
Cool. You know, I'm reflecting on how World War II as a subject of archaeology is not where I began my career. Like, I remember doing surveys on the Channel Islands in Southern California and walking past a ruined TBF Avenger that had crashed there, and the archaeologists were like, yeah, that's not really our purview. We're looking for other things. And now here it is, and it's a whole subject. And it's interesting to see that happen in archaeology over time.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I think it's weird to see that sort of almost shift, and also the technology, you know. So when I started working on the Heritage Trail, the World War II sites, we didn't have what we use today, which is photogrammetry, you know, where we can take thousands of photos of a site, feed them into a program, and have a 3D model that we can spin around and look at with high degree of accuracy. We mapped everything by hand 10 years ago with basically a tape and a slate and a pencil. But, you know, fast forward to a couple years ago, we went out and we mapped, you know, that site took us 3 days. Well, we mapped the site again in 30 minutes with
a
camera.
Big difference. Okay, we have to wrap it up there, Jennifer. Thanks so much for joining us on Underground History this month. Jennifer McKinnon, Associate Professor in the History Department at East Carolina University. Mark Tveskov from SULA, always good to see you. I expect scuba certification in your future
as
well.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.